Christopher Boehm, he wrote about, that was a guy who did all of the sort of classic bullying things that you think of as puberty emerges in high school, you know, where one guy would say to another man, I think I'm going to have sex with your wife tonight because I just really like her. And he would do this. And what happened after several weeks or months of people trying to get him to stop this incredible bullying behavior, he was killed. That, I think, is the essential dynamic that has created a very important part of the human psyche, because what it does is to shift a dominance hierarchy from one in which an individual male can bully everybody else, which is what happens in chimpanzees and gorillas and bonobos and so on. And it shifts from that to one in which the guy at the top in human society has to restrain himself.
Only humans have converted an alpha male bully into an alliance of males among whom there is a formal level of equality. And if anybody in that alliance tries to throw their weight around, they know what will happen. They will get taken out as the bully originally did. That's a podcast quote from you from a couple of years ago. And I thought it summarized a lot of one of the major books that you wrote. And I'd love to just put that to you and start the conversation from there.
Well, yes, I think this is a hugely important dynamic. It may be slightly overspoken in that quote, in the sense that the notion that somebody who speaks out of line, acts out of line, is going to get taken out is a little bit strong, because life tends to go in gentler steps than that very often. But the important dynamic is one that my late friend Christopher Boehm, identified very powerfully over the last 30 or 40 years, really, and very few people have sort of picked up on the significance of what he said. And what he did was to recognize the importance of what happens in egalitarian hunter-gatherer societies. So hunter-gatherer societies are obviously the great sort of model for where humans spent the last, say, minimum quarter of a million years and probably more in terms of our social behavior. And therefore, it's a great sort of locus of creativity for our psychology. And what you see in nomadic hunters and gatherers is that there is a kind of dominance relationship among men in particular that is utterly unknown in any other animal, and I think represents the kind of sort of essence of where we come from in terms of our much more complicated kind of sets of relationships that we have as people living in huge industrial societies. So what is this relationship? The relationship is that the men are the adult, the older men, actually particularly the married men, have egalitarian relationships with each other, in which they do not tolerate somebody who really tries to bully everybody else. And what Chris Boehm did was to go through scores of ethnographies of hunters and gatherers living in all sorts of places around the world. And mostly what all you see is that everybody is very, very nice to each other, and they're very differential. And you don't see people, men, trying to sort of score over each other and bully each other and so on. But occasionally you do. And it even gets to the point where sometimes, there was one case that I particularly remember he wrote about, where there was a guy who did all of the sort of classic bullying things that you think of as puberty emerges in high school, you know, where one guy would just say to another man, you know, I think I'm going to have sex with your wife tonight because I just really like her. And you know, there would be a protest and then there'd be a punch or something, or some equally domineering behavior. And he would do this. And what happened? You know, after several weeks or months of people trying to get him to stop this incredible bullying behavior, he was killed. He was killed by people getting together and acting in concert with each other and in surprise to him. Yeah. And that, I think, is the essential dynamic that has created a very important part of the human psyche, because what it does is to shift a dominance hierarchy from one in which an individual male can bully everybody else, which is what happens in chimpanzees and gorillas and bonobos and so on. And, you know, basically, you know, just about every other animal. And it shifts from that to one in which the guy at the top in human society has to restrain himself and is always subject to the possibility that if he goes too far, that's where this phrase of being taken out, you know, applies. And it may take quite a long time for people to really express their irritation to the point that they actually, you know, commit execution. But the, you know, the sort of thing that is so striking here is that humans are able to execute in a way that is very, very safe from the point of view of the executioners at the time that the execution happens, because they've got an agreement. They say, okay, let's do this. Other animals can't do that. Hmm. And when humans discovered that they had this potential, when they learned that, yes, you know, we guys can do something that stops us from being bullied, then not only did they realize, as a bunch of senior men who were sort of close to the alpha spot, but not actually there, that they could take out the previous alpha. Although what they were doing was taking out the individual who had the highest fighting ability in the group, and yet they could control him. Hmm. Well, that means they could control anybody. And here I think we see the discovery of a power of life and death over the alpha male and therefore of everybody else in the group that gives humans a unique society in which, often hidden from our immediate sort of awareness, we have a bunch of senior males who use their power of execution ultimately to control the whole of society. And that, you know, control is a word that sounds very intimidating, and it often is used in an intimidating way. But I should emphasize right now that this control can be for the good of society, or it can be for the bad of society. You know, it can be altruistic and pro-social, thinking about how everybody can benefit if we set up the kinds of rules that are good for everybody. Or it can be, you know, as males, we can do what we want. So we can bully the females into doing this, and we can bully the bachelors into doing that. The important thing is they can set the rules, because as everyone else in the group starts to realize, if you challenge these guys, then there's going to be trouble and you have to conform. So suddenly we move from a much more anarchic world of chimpanzees or any other primate into one in which there is a real sense of rule by the Alpha Alliance.
Hmm. This is mind-blowing stuff to someone like myself, or to, I think, many people who listen to the show who are interested in human evolution, human nature, why our societies are the way we are, why the human mind is the way it is. And my favorite book review of the last couple of years is of you. You already mentioned his name, Christopher Boehm. And I want to read a passage to you. He's written by one of my favorite writers, Rob Henderson, and get your response. It dovetails pretty nicely into the description you just gave. And I want to just read this out to you and get your thoughts on it. And I believe Boehm's book was called Hierarchy in the Forest, something like that.
Indeed. 1999.
Here's the quote from Boehm. Quote, Boehm writes, quote, hunter-gatherers understand human nature. They seem to realize that if a little authority is permitted to develop, then a normal human leader is likely to want more. The book states that both egalitarianism, status equivalency, and hierarchy are, quote, natural conditions of humanity. Everyone wants to dominate others, and everyone doesn't want to be dominated by others. Egalitarianism is an uneasy compromise. As the anthropologist Harold Schneider puts it, quote, all men seek to rule, but if they cannot rule, they prefer to be equal. I'd love to put that to you to get any other thoughts you might have on those ideas.
Boehm was brilliant because he saw the significance of this. I think I agree with everything that Rob Henderson attributed to Boehm then. It seems entirely accurate. And you know, what is so nice is that if you read the hunter-gatherer literature, you see this system in its essence. You read about men who are heavily armed, you know, they are hunters, who know all about killing, who could be very skilled in their use of their weaponry and their aggressive skills, their hunting skills, to try and put themselves ahead. And you know, you will find descriptions that Boehm was, you know, picking out and was very sensitive to, of men who were very aware of the threat that others offer to them. You know, it's not as if they were all just sort of wandering around in some kind of stone haze of lack of ambition. Not at all. You know, they compete for each other's women. They compete for status. They compete for glory within the group. But they, or at least, you know, they show lots of evidence of wanting to compete like that. But actually what they do is to be incredibly careful to avoid giving the impression that they want to show off. So, you know, that is why a man might bring a big animal, unusually big animal, back to camp and then just drop it before he gets to camp and not walk in there triumphantly showing on his shoulders, you know, a bigger hunk of meat than anyone's seen for some time. Mm. Boehm, I think, discovered the crucible, you know, the crucible of male-male relationships. And in its simplest form, I think what it means is that you've got two kinds of men. You've got the married men who have, as it were, divided up the women among themselves. And then you've got the bachelors who are being suppressed by those married men. Mm. It's really a rather different system from what you get in most primates, where the younger men are the ones who dominate the older ones, because the younger men are better fighters. Mm. And the older ones are sort of, you know, slightly put out to grass. Mm. But in humans, people often talk about the fact that particular countries might be gerontocratic. You know, I mean, obviously in the United States just recently, I mean, until recently, we had two almost 80-year-olds competing for the presidency. And you know, at a larger concept, you look at the Senate or the Congress, and the average age is somewhere in the 60s, I think. And you know, this is seems unusual, but actually, all human societies are gerontocratic, I would say, because in all of them, it is the relatively senior men who actually control things. So they're gerontocratic compared to what happens in baboons or chimpanzees, where it's the fighting individuals who are the ones who come out on top. In humans, the individual physically effective fighters are the ones who are used by the older men, thanks to the older men's skillful manipulation of the alliances, to do the fighting for them. So I'm rambling on, but anyway, you know, the short story is that Henderson and Boehm got it absolutely right.
And what are the implications of this? This seems to be such an important part of the story of humanity, of our development, of our evolution, of our culture. Why does this matter? How has this influenced the future of humanity after this capacity to execute alpha arrogant males existed? How did it affect the human story?
Well, I think it's an interesting debate that goes on sotto voce in people thinking about human social evolution between what I would think of as the standard view, which is that society consists of people who are all interested in mostly in making a society that works for the benefit of everybody in a cooperative way. Versus a society that is oriented around the power occupied by one set, one group. I mean, nowadays we often complain about people like me, the old white men, who rule society, as if this is sort of an originally very equal and cooperative society that's been taken over by these people. And so this doesn't come back to the sort of, you know, immediately felt sense in answer to your question, but I'm thinking it's still at the evolutionary level, that the correct way, I think, to think about the evolution of society is to think that the specially unique human features about it largely derive from the domination of the males. I mean, here's an example of this: these two kinds of views in practice. Take the evolution of the law. I think of the law as an institution that goes right back to the time when males first were able to kill the alpha male and impose the will of the group of males who were making sure that they were not being dominated by any other male.
Yeah.
And so that's one kind of view, and you can see, you know, how that would lead to a view of society which is, you know, tremendously important role of society, of social functions, is to stop violence within the society. And ultimately, it's the law that is responsible for that. And who is it that decides what happens in the law? Who is it that decides what the rules are in the law? Every society, it's the men. It's the old men benefiting themselves, or sometimes benefiting the group as a whole, but it's up to them to decide that. And what is striking is that if you read books about the origin of the law and where the law comes from and so on, it's, I would say, dominated by the view that The legal systems have evolved to benefit society as a whole. And it's only actually in the last something like 20 or 30 years with people like Catherine MacKinnon, that people have said, wait a minute, the law is designed around the benefits to men. I mean, as if people hadn't realized this until relatively recently. And so, Catherine MacKinnon calls for a sort of, a radical reconceptualization of what's happening in the law, and to think about the way the law applies differently to men and to women as something that is fundamentally structured within the law, as opposed to just something that has kind of emerged because people haven't been careful enough to think about the unfairness of some of the rules that have emerged to women. So, there's a kind of hidden in plain sight feature that, I mean, once you start thinking about it, then it's perfectly obvious how structured around male interests the law is. But it's not even around male interests, it's around old male interests, where old means married, basically. So it's not the bachelors. Mm-hmm. They're still the ones who are being controlled less generously than for the men of the supposedly equal high status. I hesitate with these things because I keep wanting to give a sort of straight representation from hunter-gatherer life, where you've only got two kinds of men. You've got the older married men and the younger bachelors. And obviously the competition among the various male alliances at the top of society or even lower down makes things incredibly complicated. Hmm. But I do think that the essence of it remains there.
I would love to, for how much we may know how to answer this. I think you alluded to this earlier in the conversation, and I'd love to give a little bit more space to it. But the behavior that would justify commonly the execution of a domineering man, you gave an example of someone wanting to impose himself on someone else's wife. What are the other qualities that, or behaviors that would be exhibited, maybe from what we know about existing hunter-gatherers, that would often trigger this collective male response to execute someone, to take a pretty extreme measure to eliminate someone for society for the good of, social cohesion and tranquility among the men and among the society?
Well, I think certainly violence is the major, I would say, is the major one. And that continues today. I mean, nowadays we put people in prison. Prison hasn't been a very common feature of society until about 200 or 300 years ago, when it became easier to organize prisons. And until then, execution was much more prevalent. But obviously, killers nowadays, murderers, are the people that we make sure get stopped. In hunter-gatherer society, men who threaten, or anybody actually who threaten the existing arrangement by which the men are in control and have cultural systems that support that control, they are vulnerable. They will be trying to be coerced. Here's one sort of incredibly striking example of a threat to the cultural system. In a lot of societies, what you have is some kind of secret society among the men. And so where this is older men who come together, they go off to some supposedly secret place, a couple of hundred yards from the main camp, something like that, and do weird things together. And one of the weird things they do is to to blow the sacred trumpets, that sort of thing, and then come back and report to everybody that the gods, as it were, have been making these noises and come with some sort of message, reinforcing the message that, yes, you know, men are supposed to get the best cuts of meat and women are supposed to get the poorer cuts, you know, or some equivalent to that. And there is a report that I've often cited of an event in Australia among hunters and gatherers there. It was reported in the 1930s from the previous generation, and it was a case where two women came upon the men in their secret society, you know, blowing the sacred trumpets, and then the men discovered the women having seen this, and it's all meant to be really secret, you know, because they do not want the women saying, "Hey, wait a minute, it's not the gods at all," you know. And the men came back and talked to themselves and said, "Well, when should we put the women to death?" And they said, "Immediately," and they did. And so this is, I think, an example of where you see the men protecting their right to be able to impose their will on the whole of society, and they're able to do so because of this dynamic of controlling the tyrants. So I think that a second category after violence is a threat to the cultural system that unites the men in the face of the rest of society. And then a third category that I think is worth drawing attention to is individuals who are rather poorly integrated into the rest of society. And this could be because they have no relatives. It could be because they are, as it were, poor. So that might mean, in the context of hunters and gatherers, unable to fend for themselves very well. Maybe they've got paralyzed limb or some kind of disability. And ordinarily, the ethos of the society would definitely be to support people like that. But under circumstances in which its life is tough for everybody, then that's when you might get a rumor starting saying, you know, the reason that it hasn't rained for a long time, I think it's because, you know, Bert there is irritating the gods. And so I'm just giving this, you know, the broad principle of notion that unallied men during tough times might be accused of contributing to problems. And they just might be sacrificed, as it were. So I think, you know, there's a variety of ways in which the power is used. And it's, what is so striking is that when they decide to do it, it's kind of horrifyingly effective in terms of our modern sensibilities.
Yeah. Incredible stuff. And I wonder, I remember last night I was watching an interview you gave where you talked about, and I know you've spent a lot of your career working and observing chimps and learning about chimp raids. And the numbers I think you gave were something like, chimps have a very good understanding of when the numbers are in their favor to be able to successfully execute quote unquote enemy chimps. And it's something like 8-1.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wonder for yourself with us, with humans, how you think this capacity for execution and, you know, this tacit understanding that all men have probably that they need to keep their despotic tendencies in check or else they're at risk as well. How you think that may have formed or shaped our moral impulses psychologically. I know you've thought about that from interviews I've seen. I'd love to give a little space to how you think that has affected how people, and maybe men specifically, are our own breaks that we may have developed to put on these more domineering, tyrannical tendencies that seem to be quite natural.
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that. I'm not sure what you're thinking about. You know, I'm very struck by exactly the point you make with chimps, because I think this provides a really nice model for the control of aggression. So the control within an individual. You know, I think that in many ways it's useful to think of humans as a species that is evolved to conduct aggression under certain circumstances. And those circumstances do not include one-on-one meetings where you might get hurt.
Yeah.
You know, we have a very low tendency to get into fights of that type. I mean, if you're in a bar full of booze, then that tendency becomes easier, becomes more likely. But most people will move away from an opportunity to fight, unless you are with a bunch of other men and your victim is alone. And you know, sociologists have certainly drawn attention to the fact that fighting is enormously increased in likelihood under those conditions, when you have several individuals all able to back each other up around one individual. And of course, you know, obviously it's very practical, this aspect. I mean, you know, when I think about it with chimps, and the 8-to-1 ratio, which is the average when a chimp gets killed by other chimps, the victim is alone against 8 other males. You know, what that means is that one can hold a foot, another can hold another foot, you know, so 4 of them can each hold a limb, and then you've got one helpless individual, and then the rest can do what they want, which is not cricket. You know, it's not fair, but life isn't fair. Life is taking advantage of opportunity. And, you know, what we find with chimps is that if you play the call of an enemy chimp to a group of males or to a group of females, you find that the probability that they go forward and search for the source of this fake male, it's a male that we just played the call of, the probability that they're going forward absolutely depends on the number of males in the group. And you have to have at least 4 or 5 before they will go all the way and search for the tape recorder that produced the calls. Hmm. You know, they are very, very sensitive to their numbers. And we don't know exactly how that happens. You know, have they sort of always got an internal sense of how many are around them, or do they need to sort of check and look around? It doesn't seem very obvious, but maybe, you know, we've missed it so far. And I'm sure that something like that happens in humans, that you know, courage comes from having support. And so, you know, I'm sure all of us have been at some point or another walking down a dark street, and you feel a bit of a difference when you see 4 or 5 men coming along side by side with each other and obviously comfortable with each other, to when you're just passing one individual. I mean, it's, you know, the game of numbers is perfectly obvious.
Yeah.
I think what's, you know, what seems likely is that we have been, we've evolved to make that game of numbers something that we're very, very sensitive to.
I know you write a lot about this concept of proactive and reactive aggression or violence in people. And my understanding, and please correct me where I'm wrong here, is that the proactive aggression, the multi-party planning that we see in human warfare in all of history, is still very much with us. But the reactive aggression the tendency for reactive violence has been mitigated significantly in the course of human evolutionary history, you know, perhaps largely because of the explanation that you just gave about our own capacity to self-domesticate. And I'd love to give you an opportunity to speak to how much of that reactive aggression is still with us. I think I heard it said once that, you know, the reactive aggression that you see in most two-year-old boys has been socialized out of them by the time they're around five. But there are still a small percentage of boys that grow into men who never really get rid of that. And those tend to be the men that cause most of the problems in society, at least in a violent, aggressive sense. I just wanted to put that to you to give your thoughts on how much of this reactive tendency in your mind is still, you know, still with us, still with human nature.
Yeah. So, you know, I do find this distinction really, really valuable between the proactive, which is premeditated, predatory, planned aggression, where somebody can be quite calm and not showing any particular emotion. Hmm. And which I think there's no evidence that that has decreased in any way during human evolution. It's very characteristic of hunting species, and it's probably maintained a high level ever since we got onto the savannah and significantly increased our amount of effort devoted to getting meat. And then on the other hand, reactive aggression, which does seem to have fallen enormously. So the standard statistic that I produce on this is that in a study of a human group where they were judged to be particularly frequent fighters, as partly as a result of alcohol and partly as a result of terrible things happening to their society. You know, this is a group of Australian hunter-gatherers who had been sort of incorporated into modern society without any kind of effective alternative to just standing around doing nothing all day. I exaggerate, but nevertheless, you know, one of these classic cases of real social disturbance. When you compare the frequency of fighting among them, physical fighting, with physical fighting among chimpanzees, it was something like between 500 and 1,000 times less in the humans than in the chimps. Mm. And that was, as I say, a society where there was a lot of fighting. Yeah. So it is very, very dramatic. But you're asking, what about the cases where it still does occur? And it's a great point about children, that babies come sort of much more chimp-like, ready to react to another child with a slap or a bite or a fight or whatever it is, and that has to be socialized out of us. Using often a little bit of proactive aggression to socialize it out of the kids. But what about the adults where, you know, we worry much more about those individuals who are liable to be a threat to society? And I don't actually think that it's the reactive aggressors that are so important there. Hmm. It seems to me that, I mean, it's quite true that in samples of criminal activity in Europe and US, you can find maybe half the murderers, it varies in different samples, being reactive murderers as opposed to proactive murderers. But then, of course, when you come to the real big killing in humans, which is in war,
yeah,
then reactive aggression has a much lower place. It does have a place, and you know, when you think of Khrushchev slapping his shoe on the table at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and you know, the similar sorts of cases, leaders who control the lives of many people, they can react with reactive aggression, not in the sense of actually getting into a rough and tumble with the opponent, but in sense of leading an army, a country, into war. But mostly, I don't think that is the way that it happens, but my reading of history. I would like to draw attention to the fact that morality, I think, plays a quite important part in all of this. So morality is behavior that is conducted according to an internal sense of right and wrong. And that internal sense comes from often externally expressed senses of what is right and wrong, of course. Mm. And the so within society, there is very little use of proactive lethal aggression, at least, because people act according to a sense of right and wrong. And it's wrong to do such and such. It applies more to proactive than reactive, because reactive aggression obviously is much less likely to be governed by conscience and much more by impulse.
Yeah.
Proactive aggression is governed by conscience. Well, the reason I draw attention to this is because of a question about the evolution of psychopathy, the occurrence of psychopaths. So about 2% of men in most samples, or sometimes they say 1 to 2%, that sort of thing, of men are judged to be psychopaths, a little bit less for women. Hmm. Obviously it's a sliding scale, but the essence of psychopathy is not acting by a sense of right and wrong. It's not having a conscience. And it's not that the psychopaths are unintelligent. You know, they can understand the concept of right and wrong. They just don't care to modify their behavior according to the standards that they know perfectly well are out there. Now, that means that they are not moral in the way that we think of humans as being. This is something that applies to animals too. Chimpanzees do not act by a sense of right and wrong, and nor do any other animals. So what happened? Well, when you got this dynamic we've been talking about of a group of males being able to take out a tyrant, then they were able to impose their sense of what was appropriate in society as a result of their ability to kill and therefore coerce and threaten people. And then there was a selection pressure in favor of individuals who behaved according to what was right and wrong. In other words, what the domineering group, the alliance of males, considered was the best from their interest, which very often was best for society as a whole. So in other words, the evolution of a sense of right and wrong began at that point, on which I think we can date rather firmly to around 300,000 years ago. Hmm. And that meant at that point, psychopathy started to be reduced in favor of an increased sense of conscience. But it hasn't gone completely. And so, you know, some people think that psychopathy is a disease. And some think it's kind of in a stable relationship with society, because in a generally benign society, a few malign actors can get away with it. But the alternative that I favor is that what we're seeing in the existence of psychopaths nowadays is the dwindling representation of a proportion of people that have been subject to selection for the last 300,000 years, selection mm. against them. Mm. Just as every other species, they're all psychopaths. You know, chimps are all psychopaths. Gorillas are all psychopaths. And we just got a few left of humans who are psychopaths. And so I think rather than extreme reactive aggressors as being the most sort of dangerous represent the ones who impose most violence on society, I think probably it's going to be the remnant psychopaths that do that. Partly because a lot of them escape. You know, I mean, the reactive fighters get caught. It's you know, they don't try and hide what they're doing. They just get into fights, and then they get, you know, caught by the police or the community. But the psychopaths are full of proactive aggression, and they can plan and get away with things.
2 in 100 is not high, but that's a lot of people in this world. And I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to this are asking this question in their head. How can someone learn how to look out for that kind of person in this world? And also, is it in your mind, is psychopathy something that is more you're born with this quality, like you would with a certain type of skin color? Or is there, are there cultural incentives that can elicit more psychopathic behavior in someone as they are in different environments?
Yeah, I'm sure both are true.
Yeah.
I think it's normally thought that around 50% of the variance in psychopathy is due to genes. So, you know, to some extent born, but even, of course, if you have those tendencies, it can be educated out of you. So, you know, it's just like every other human behavior, it's a complex mix of inborn and developed through experience. You know, kids who are bigger than others in their peer group, they tend, it seems, to learn that they can get away with bullying others, you know, depending on how well they're being managed, as it were. And so they will have a tendency as they grow up to be proactive bullies. But I must admit, I don't know how many of them will go on to act with very low regard for a moral conscience. So, you know, and as for recognizing them, I have no special sort of, you know, sense of how to do that. You know, I mean, the word psychopathy is thrown around a lot. In the public realm, and I think we all have to judge for ourselves the extent to which people are acting, you know, on a fundamentally selfish basis without regard for others. But of course, you know, it's complicated because they're often very smart people who know how to disguise what they're doing, and that means that, you know, they're hard to discern.
Any other tips for that might be a tell for someone to, you know, believe that they may be, you know, associating with or meeting someone who would meet that criteria? I mean, already in my head, a couple people that I've known and worked with in my life come to mind. But are there any other, is it truly just outrightly selfish, enduring behavior with total disregard for other people, that's sort of the hallmark here? Or are there other things that you might point to?
Well, no, I don't think I do have any insights to offer on that. But I would just say that you know, the phrase total disregard for others, a successful psychopath would not reveal himself or herself to show total disregard for others.
Yeah.
You know, what they would do would be having some kind of internal process of saying, in order for me to look like someone who has a conscience, you know, I need to behave in such and such a benign way from time to time, or in appropriate circumstances.
Yeah.
So, you know, as I say, I think it's a substantial challenge. And, you know, people who have been accusing Donald Trump of being a psychopath have been responded to by people who are clinical psychologists or psychiatrists are saying, look, you can't say that. You've got to have an in-depth investigation before you really know what the difference is between someone who's normal on this scale and someone who is psychopathic.
Fair. I know as well. I mean, you've had such a hell of a career, Richard, and I learned recently about your work, I think, at the beginning of your career with Jane Goodall in Africa many decades ago. And, a lot of these topics they can get fairly dark pretty quickly. And I wonder for yourself, with how long you've been studying human evolution, human nature, how you think about humans at this point in your life, in this point in your career. Obviously, that's a massive question, but in general, I know the word you use in your book is paradox, that we are both capable of more destruction than any other animal in history, and also of the deepest of kindnesses. I'd love to give a little space to you to give your current thinking on that subject, on human nature as you see it in general.
Well, let me begin with chimpanzee nature.
Sure.
Your mention of Jane Goodall brings to mind the fact that I was in Gombe, which she established as a study location of chimpanzees in the early 1970s, when our team was discovering that chimpanzees killed each other. Until that point, Jane had not been aware of the extreme violence that chimpanzees showed to each other. And what she was impressed by was the fact that mother-offspring relationships showed all the tenderness that we expect from our human experience, that there was sharing of meat, sharing of food among the chimps, which seemed astonishingly cooperative and generous compared to what we think of as in other animals. There were greetings that were reminiscent of humans with all our sense of appreciation for each other, when chimps would reach out and just sort of touch each other and pat each other and maybe kiss each other. So the world in which I was introduced to the chimps in Gombe was a world in which Jane was really emphasizing what a nice species they are. Mm. And then these dark sides started emerging. It was first infanticide, killing an infant from a neighboring group, and then killing adults from neighboring groups. And then later it turns out that there might be killings even within groups of both infants and sometimes of adults. So there's a lot of violence that mounts up over time. And so Jane, of course, was asked what she thought about this, given the fact that she had portrayed them as living in an open society with just lots of friendly gestures and loving relationships and so on. And she said, well, what this means is that chimps are even more like humans than I originally thought, because they show both our good sides and our bad sides. Mm. And of course, anyone who knows humans knows that we have these two sides. But it is remarkable that for 200 or 300 years of political philosophy, people have been divided between the views represented iconically between Thomas Hobbes and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. In other words, between we are fundamentally violent and competitive and we're civilized by our experience in society, which is what Hobbes said, or we are fundamentally generous and kind, as Rousseau said, but we are corrupted by society. So, there's been tremendous desire to see one or the other side as core to our sense of ourselves, and then everything else layered on top of that and changing us. And I think what's exciting about the new kind of view is that our paradoxical nature can be integrated into a sense that, you know, we really are both, in the sense that our psyche has evolved for both sides. And your question to me was, what does this make me feel? Something like that, about you know, future of the human species, my personal role in it, that sort of thing. And I think everybody wants a positive story, of course. You know, we're born with hope as a very important emotion for us, motivating us in life. And I think there is a very sort of coherent reason for hoping, which is that the essential problem on the dark side is with proactive violence. It's, you know, that's the one responsible for war. It's responsible for the sort of subtle meanness, occasionally going to violence, that pervades society much more than the open, impulsive fighting that is occasional, but is more easily suppressed. And the thing about proactive violence is that it is only undertaken when the individual concerned conceives that it is going to pay off. You know, this is not some kind of inevitable display that just comes bursting out from time to time, just like hunger if you don't get any food. No, you know, if you are living in a society in which our social arrangements are such that it is persistently difficult to see how this kind of proactive aggression could pay off, then it just won't happen. That's the sort of, you know, the positive aspect. In other words, in theory, we should be able to design society in a way that allows our good sides to flourish and suppresses our horrid tendency to use power in a way that is selfishly beneficial, even at the expense of someone else's comfort or life. So that's the positive aspect. The trouble with that is that it is actually very difficult to see how you do arrange that. I think that a lot of the way that we can conceive of the evolution of civilization is as a way to suppress violence. You know, I'm a total fan of what Steve Pinker did in The Better Angels of Our Nature, going through the literature and recording very carefully all the ways in which there is evidence of decreasing violence over the last decades, centuries, and even millennia. And I think he's absolutely right about that. And I think a lot of that is due to increasing abilities to stop people getting into circumstances in which it pays them to conduct violence. So that's evidence, I think, of, you know, of this good side. So that, you know, the hope is that we can just carry on increasing. The problem, you know, war is a major problem here. And although people have fantasized about it for years, of course, for millennia, you know, the notion of a world government that would suppress war is really, really difficult to imagine in a way that doesn't come with all sorts of other appalling consequences. You know, the mantra that I find it very difficult to escape from is power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And as Lord Acton continued, great men are almost always bad men. So, you know, I think of it as a continuing challenge. It's a continuing challenge in which very likely there will be violence continuing in the future from time to time. You know, it's difficult to look around the world right now and see what's happening in pretty much every continent. And escape the thought that it's going to be quite a long time before violence gets taken out altogether. You know, I'm not a fan of the notion that the long peace, basically the young European and American peace since 1945, is a serious signal of the future. I worry that that's more related to the observation that the longer that that countries go without war, then the more dangerous and violent the war is that comes at the end of it. But I do think that the long-term trend is, you know, can reasonably be expected to be positive. But, you know, only provided that people sort of think about it and aware about it. And I'm often criticized, either openly or behind my back, I think, for writing about the evolution of violence and for being, you know, interested in it. And, you know, my critics call me an apologist for war, as if I sort of, you know, think it's a good thing, which of course I don't, and nobody does. And I find it worrying that there are persistent threads of thought that simply say, if we can just go back to the past, we would go back to a peaceful existence. And the reason I find it worrying is because it implies that you can get away without the institutions that control violence. But I think that the institutions that control violence are really important. And there's not just within society, but also between, you know, the treaties and societies make with each other, the laws that people try and make to outlaw, you know, terrible weapons or gender violence or whatever. You know, these institutions are human creations that are absolutely necessary if we are going to continue the trend towards suppressing violence.
Yeah. Some hope there. And, yeah. You know, we I know we didn't even get to the other major area of your work that is so crucial to the human story, I think, and so interesting, which is around fire and cooking. And I mean, some of the most interesting things just in researching for that component, and maybe we can have a conversation about that specifically at some point in the future, because I know we're close to time, but the role of cooking and pre-digesting food, how many more calories you get from cooking food, how much time is saved in this. These are just ideas that had never really occurred to me before coming across your work. And I know we're getting very close or are at the end of the time we have together today. So I wanted to close with a quote I heard from you that I know I wanted to bring up with you. I think other people I had spoken about talking to you with wanted to get your thoughts on this as well. And it's an expansion of some ideas and a quote that I've heard you say on a podcast, which is related, I think, to violence and some of your concerns about that threat for humanity. And here's a quote, and I'd love to end with getting your thoughts on this. And it's, quote, "I think it'd be a very good idea if there were no Y chromosomes, because the ultimate source of violence is in the Y chromosome." Y chromosome, obviously talking about men here. You know, I know for some people that have heard you speak about this in the past, there's not a ton of clarity around what exactly you mean when you are talking about that or bring up an idea like that. But I'd love to give you, in closing, some space to articulate what exactly in your mind, and maybe that was tongue in cheek, but I would love to get your thoughts on those ideas specifically from you.
I mean, I feel slightly awkward talking about this because obviously it's, you know, it's totally science fiction.
Yeah.
Practical point of view. I am certainly completely persuaded that males are overwhelmingly responsible for violence. You know, I do not think that this is, a lot of it is just women wanting to be violent and getting men to do the violence for them. I'm not saying that women are totally pacifist themselves and they're not capable of violence, but the enormous majority of the practice of violence is due to men, due to the Y chromosome. And we see that, we see easy explanations for that in terms of our evolutionary biology and the male competition with each other. So I think about the fact that we have these appalling weapons nowadays and retain a strong tendency for our groups to get into fights. We have so far, since 1945, managed not to have nuclear bombs used in hostility. But there have been accidents already, of course, there have also been, you know, threats to use them, and there are threats to use them even now. And when you think about the long term, you know, you think about a few thousand years, a few tens of thousands of years, it seems impossible to imagine that these kinds of weapons will not be used. And once they get used, then obviously, you know, the threat of escalation that could be really completely devastating is very high. So in the long term, I do think that that Y chromosomes are something that we would be better off without as a species. And I can see various ways of getting there, none of which are realistic. You know, here's one way to get there. You just agree that with the reproductive technology that will probably emerge within the next 100 years, but, you know, pretty quickly in the large scheme of things, you know, even if it took 1,000 years, it'll be probably possible for women to have babies, probably not in their wombs, but in a tube of some kind, without involving sperm, or only with involving sperm that have X chromosomes. And then, of course, the difficulty is that you would get renegade, they would get tremendous selection pressure in favor of individuals who could control the thing and then become the equivalent of the sperm donor who suddenly finds that he's got 50 children. You know. In other words, there'd be a takeover by some men. And then, you know, so there's a science fiction story to be had in there. But it's difficult to see in practice how the world could agree, even without any killing, but I'm not suggesting any killing, but that you just have an agreement that all women produce only daughters. And so, you know, that's a problem, and I don't know how it would work. Another possible solution would be this. When you go to Mars, you just make sure only women go. You just don't send men. And then when men blow themselves up on Earth, there's a single-sex colony on Mars. And again, you know, I want to emphasize, I'm not suggesting that women are so peaceful that there wouldn't be any problems, but I think they would have more common sense and greater ability to figure out a long-term future without ego having quite such a domineering role. So that, you know, that might be possible, but I recognize that all of these, I mean, well, both those ways are incredibly unlikely for all sorts of reasons. But I think it's worth at least thinking about the fact that the human species has a problem, and it's a problem that, you know, at the moment, the only way we know how to really take care of it is through institutions. And, you know, if we could wave a magic wand, I think that the future of the human species would be to have only women. And then you'd have the problem that women love men, and men are sort of quite nice to have around. And so somehow you'd have to satisfy them. I'm not talking necessarily about sexual issues, but that's an issue as well. But in terms of relationship issues, life would be very different. But to think about an evolutionarily stable system for the human species over the long term, I just find it very difficult to imagine how it's going to happen if you have men and if you have competing nations. And both of those, I think the Y chromosome is a problem.
Fair. What would you think about, hypothetically, with advanced technology of just removing, genes that are highly associated with extreme aggression, rather than a blanket removal of men from the population? And again, I know you said this is science fiction, but in general, is it your view that the removal of men in totality is, an absolute must, or are there some more nuanced alternatives that might mitigate the long-term risk that you're really concerned with here?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's actually probably a much better idea, really. One of the things that has happened in evolutionary time, in the time of Homo sapiens, is a reduction in the degree of sex difference. And, look at us. So we're trying to exaggerate that with our being shaved, not having beards, which just represents a sort of feminization that has been going on at a real level in terms of, the degree of difference in the thickness of our bones or the breadth of our faces. And so, if the timing is right and in terms of the rate at which this could happen in relationship to the threats, yes, I think it's a much better idea than the science fiction notion of getting rid of the Y chromosome and not removing it in terms of killing, but just letting it go away. And I think the difficulty is that, or the conceptual difficulty at the moment is that we don't know enough about the genes to be able actually to do that. But I think it's a very reasonable idea that that we will get to know enough about the genes to be able to domesticate us in that way. This is an area of fairly active research looking at the genetic differences between domesticated species of mammals and their wild ancestors. And there is some preliminary evidence that of beginning to identify those genes, and in fact of finding that there are parallels in the particular genes that are involved between the differences of between domesticated and wild animals and between humans, sapiens, and Neanderthals. In other words, we are domesticated and reduced in reactive aggression compared to Neanderthals. So I love it. I think the idea of really focusing on that and allowing males to continue in a sort of much more gracile, smiley, feminized, less bearded way will be much, much better than the hope of getting rid of them by having all female species.
Richard, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you giving me the time. I learned so much by devouring your work over the last week or two. So thank you for the time. Thank you for all the years you've put into your work and your appearances publicly. I really appreciate it.
You are so kind. It's really an honor to come on your podcast.
Thank you.